All right. We left off talking about the rise of the American Empire and the decision that was made at the turn of the century. Really, it began with the Spanish-American War in many ways, but it was concluded, the decision that is, with the resulting Filipino insurrection and the desire, more so the decision that was made by the McKinley administration, among others, who had been pushing for the United States to become a truly global power on the world stage so as to contend with Britain and France, for example, in the social Darwinistic game of conquest, the decision to annex the Philippines in a direct or in a direct fashion, thanks to the Paris Peace Conference of October of 1898. To put this in a proper historical context and what I believe is one of the true watershed moments in all of American history, it sets the United States on a course toward empire, and that decision has dramatic ramifications for today, rendering the United States as the most imperialistic power in the world as of right now. Sorry if that makes you feel uncomfortable. It's just an apparent fact. I thought we'd take a look at a book that came out just a couple years ago in 2016 by Stephen Kinzer, who's a historian at Boston University. Boston University's kind of taken a reputational hit since a certain New York congresswoman who happens to be 29 years of age has her economics degree from there and yet knows little to no economics, and that's pretty apparent. So feel free to – I don't think you have to do much research on the person to whom I'm alluding. Great. So about AOC just for a moment, I guess I should comment since I just – sort of poke the hornet's nest there. I have to say she's thoroughly entertaining. She is thoroughly entertaining when she gets up and she, what I find a bit not so entertaining about her, but a little bit dangerous, is I've never seen someone so lacking in intelligence and knowledge of something and yet so self-assured about it. It's so absolutely, Brian. Do you see that with when she speaks? There's no air of hesitancy or contemplation that maybe her position is wrong, or more so the arguments and justifications she has for the position she has. My favorite one was, I don't know if you've heard, but she and a number of other New York more socialistic leaning Democratic politicians have just essentially driven out Amazon. Amazon has two new HQs going in. One's going to be in Northern Virginia, and the other one was going to be in New York on Long Island, as I recall. But this would provide New York City and New Yorkers, get this, with 25,000 well-paying jobs. These are not the working in the warehouse jobs. These are six-figure salaries. And AOC, she protested that the state government and municipal governments were giving tax credits. And she said, well, now that Amazon's leaving, that's billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars that could be spent on schools and in local infrastructure. She doesn't know. She was an economics major. She doesn't know clearly the difference between tax credits and subsidies. Subsidies would be something where the government pays someone and funds and finances some venture. That's a subsidy. A tax credit is just stealing less. You just decide, I'm going to steal less in taxation from you. I'm not kidding. That's what a tax credit is. That's how it functions. Now, I'm all on board with the whole idea that it is unfair that Amazon gets massive tax credits. I understand that. And the way to do away with that and level the playing field in terms of small businesses versus big businesses is to eliminate the government altogether. I'm just saying, I'm just throwing it out there. But in the absence of that, stealing less from a company that will generate far more in the long term of actual taxation dollars and funds to the government, which I'm not a fan of, remember, but still would do that, is so counter. It's not counterintuitive because I don't think she has an intuition, but it's more, it's just stupid. It's just so stupid and myopic, very short-sighted and convoluted that, I mean, it's because she's thinking that now that money is going to go to schools. There was no money. And there's certainly no money now because Amazon's going somewhere else. Mackenzie. Oh, it's gigantic. Oh, it's gigantic. Well, think about these really vapid and unproven arguments about when baseball or football stadia are built throughout the country and the supposed economic benefits. By the way, the Olympics in your city is a boondoggle. You don't want the Olympics there in the city. It's turned out to be economically suppressive of a regional or metropolitan area. And there's little evidence actually that baseball stadia do that. They might revitalize a neighborhood, but that's only targeting more sort of concentrating wealth in an area which might have otherwise been spread out throughout a city or something along those lines. That's not to say that culturally there's something there with having a sports team and civic pride, but that's hard to measure economically speaking. The benefits of having Amazon in your area are clear. Think about it, 25,000 six-figure jobs. Just in terms of consumption, and I'm not a Keynesian. I don't believe that the economy is wealthier when we consume more. If that was the case, every rapidly obese person would be a billionaire. Now, that's kind of a weird metaphor. But I'm not saying what I'm arguing is that it's not consumption, but consumption does drive economic growth. Because, of course, productive capabilities have to meet the consumption and the demand, right? So 25,000 – and then that's not even counting the other jobs that are given to people, which are much more numerous but not as well paying. But still, these people are going to lunch. They're traveling. And, yes, there are infrastructure concerns. You have to build more roads, right? Now, again, as an anarcho-capitalist, we would argue that the government doesn't have to do that. But the government would do that. But in the long run, the economic benefit, I don't know what the estimates are, because I'm not sure if Amazon has ventured in this way to build these type of headquarters prior to this. I know there's one obviously in Washington State and other locales as well. But what the measure of the economic impact of a new facility is hard to gauge. But it would have to be in the positive. Right. Brian, did you have your hand up? Right. And give her credit, like the sadly best of politicians, she's impervious to fact. You see? So she'll deflect or along those lines. She's skilled in that regard. Matt, real quickly. They don't know yet, as far as I know, that Mr. Bezos hasn't made a – Jeff Bezos hasn't made a decision. Refer to him as Mr. Bezos. He's not I don't think he's a great guy. He is, by definition, a political entrepreneur. He's looking for ways to use the government, as per Burton Folsom's distinction that we know from the Gilded Age, to use government so as to gain advantage in a kind of protectionist way. That being said, as much as you might dislike him, he cheated on his wife, apparently. They're going through a nasty divorce. That's going to be one heck of a settlement, I would think, considering he's the CEO of the largest corporation that's ever existed in history. So all that being said, he has created a model as an entrepreneur that has revolutionized the way we attain goods and services, and nothing short of it. I forget the last estimate. I believe this strikes me as accurate, but 27% of retail purchases are done on Amazon. That's a lot. Therefore, you can understand why this has led to the downfall of stores such as Sears and other used to be large retailers. And frankly, if you look at those retailers that are still in business, like Walmart, they are tailoring their customer purchase experiences alongside of Amazon, or with Amazon-like features of curb drop off and pickup. Well, not drop off, but pickup. You see, that's to combat Amazon, right? It's essentially they're saying you don't want to wait for a package to come via UPS or USPS, which is going to take much longer. But so just go to the store. You can pick it up online just like you would buy at Amazon. You can go right to Walmart. You don't have to go through the lines. Deal with people. Danny, real quickly, you had your hand up.
Oh, I was just thinking about this video I saw a couple weeks ago of Cortez and on the study, which is like, senators, let's play a game. Have you seen that video?
No.
She started saying, what if I could use a bunch of illegal money to pay for myself? All of a sudden, just going along that, and the guy's like, good. All the stuff you said, you can't really do. You should really just like read up on it.
Really?
She was just like completely making up like a hypothetical situation where they were talking about something completely different. And then everyone on Twitter was like, I'd love for a queen, like, yes.
Right, but you have to understand there is a, it might be surface level and perception and optics, but there is an attraction to socialism.
And also, there were like two separate interviews. There were like 12 hours apart. That actually like took part in it. The first one, she said that then like the whole system, she like advocated for. And the third required like massive government.
Oh, the Green New Deal.
And then the second. Said that, like, everybody's afraid that
it
would require massive government
intervention, but, like, that's a good thing. Yeah. Right. Although, to be fair, you know, Donald Trump won pretty much with the same modus operandi, politically speaking. There's a great YouTube of Trump of saying how he's the greatest. It's just a series of the most absurd, I'm the greatest, I know the most about tariff policy. Everyone is an idiot compared to me regarding the military. It's just a whole long line of things. And no one knows more about North Korea than I do. Something like that. It's just all these grandiose, unprovable, irrational statements. It's pretty funny. Great. So I brought up Boston University. So here's the connection. And that was, again, Stephen Kinzer has written this book. It's a really remarkable work, if you ever have the time to read it, as I have. And it's entitled The True Flag: Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. I would categorize Mark Twain among the most successful and biting critics of American imperialism. He's among the anti-imperialists. And as such, he's going to form a kind of intellectual businessman, even labor leader coalition of sorts, to argue against this move for the United States in a very hypocritical way, given America's history, to become an overseas empire, even beyond the hypocrisy of subduing Native American tribes in North America throughout Manifest Destiny. I went to the library, and rather than purchasing the book myself, this is what public libraries afford us. You might be saying, oh, you're an anarcho-capitalist, you shouldn't be at a public library. Well, I'm sorry, if the thief's going to give you back some of the services that he stole from you, I'll take them. Anyway, there's my justification, right? If you get robbed of $100 and the thief mails you back your wallet, you're not like, I'm out of principle, I'm not going to use this wallet anymore. No, that's ridiculous. You'd still use the wallet. Anyway, just in case you were wondering if I was also guilty of hypocrisy, I am not. I'm being consistent. I took pictures and scanned a few pages that I wanted to share with you, and these are available on Schoology in this True Flag PDF. And you can either follow along on the screen, but we're going to read through the introduction. There are several other pages that I've included here. Thank you. Uh-oh. Danny, are you late or something?
No.
Sorry. I hate giving those out right in the middle of a lesson. Now you're distracted, right? Not you. You have laser focus, Fiorito. I'm not worried about you. So I went and scanned these. There are other pages beyond the introduction that we're going to read together. and I want to analyze together about the true flag, this book, they might appear on an exam. They might appear on an essay question. It could happen. All I'm saying is it's a possibility. Okay? You're not mandated in reading them, but you're going to be given all the tools to assess, as you already have the tools. But if you have prompts, you're going to be able to answer any of the questions that pertain to them just by what we're doing in class. So I might ask, I hope you don't mind my voice and the monotone nature of it at times. Forgive me if that is you're sick of hearing it. But for the purpose of recording for our peers who are out, I'm just going to read it. And then if you have any questions, we'll stop and comment and we'll go from there. See what you think of this. How should the United States act in the world? Americans can't decide. For more than a century, we've debated with ourselves. We can't even agree on the question. Put one way, should we defend our freedom or turn inward and ignore growing threats? Put differently, should we charge violently into faraway lands or allow others to work out their own destinies? Note, do these two questions fit neatly into the paradigm we've already established about the nature of the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era, even as it regards foreign policy? What did most people prefer regarding the questions that ought to be asked about American involvement in foreign affairs in the world? What questions were predominantly asked in the Gilded Age? Which set? The former or the latter? There are two sets of questions here, right? Put one way, we should defend our freedom or turn inward and ignore growing threats. Put differently, second set, we should charge violently into faraway lands. Or should we allow others to work out their own destinies, Kelsey? This one is in the Gilded Age? That's former, right? So the first one, A, would be more Gilded Age questions, you're saying? Okay. Oh, I see. Right. Okay. No, what I'm saying is regarding the disposition of individuals regarding foreign affairs, they would most likely ask themselves before acting, should we defend our freedom or turn inward toward growing threats? In other words, the disposition there is self-defense, that the military or foreign policy should be focused upon just internal affairs. Maybe if you consider internal threats to be Native Americans on the frontier, that would qualify. But otherwise, essentially, the attitude is we're not going to go off and do the charging violently into faraway lands to establish an American empire sort of thing. Does that make sense? I see your point in terms of people in the Gilded Age would say this is stupid, the second part, these second questions. Thoughts here? Mackenzie?
As in, like, a sarcastic tone
towards,
like, a little bit, should we charge violently in foreign land?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Would they propose this in such a violent and clear manner, apparent manner? But as you know from your reading through the Taft administration in the Progressive Era for today, did indeed Theodore Roosevelt and at least at the beginning, William Randolph Hearst, members of the Yellow Press like Joseph Pulitzer, Henry Cabot Lodge, did they justify their actions for the imposition of American ideals, democracy, freedom upon foreign peoples, and say the justification for the violence that occurs is the means justifies the ends? I think the answer to that is pretty clear. Yes, they did. I mean, to the point where I shared with you that correspondence just before World War I when Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt are writing to one another, and they're saying something's wrong with the country. We feel very fractured. We need a good war. Let's try to pick a fight with Germany. I mean, imagine that. This is in the record. Of course, they were private letters, but they're later revealed to be the correspondence between these two very war hawkish, very imperialistic American exceptionalists. They believed that the United States had something exceptional to offer the rest of the world. And if it needed to be imposed upon, if these elements of American culture, civilization, politics, economics needed to be imposed upon others, well, then so be it. Next paragraph. Our enthusiasm for foreign intervention seems to ebb and flow like the tides, or swing back and forth like a pendulum. At some moments, we are aflame with righteous anger. Confident in our power, we launch wars and depose governments. Then chastened, we retreat until the cycle begins again. What do you think of Kinzer's analysis of modern American foreign affairs and actions in the world? Does our worry, consternation with that desire to impose American ideals on the rest of the world and systems ebb and flow like waves or swing like pendula?
I think this is kind of around the midst of the idea that we touched upon where you were saying that America will get very fired up and hyped up about starting a war with Spain, like the Spanish-American War, and then they'll kind of back out and kind of retreat into themselves. And then when the other country starts war again, then they get hyped up again.
Yeah, there is that weird dynamic where Americans feel as though they need to be always fighting a defensive war and allow themselves, or maybe ourselves, to call it that.
Yeah, and I feel that sort of dipping and, you know, peaking interest is kind of a product of that dynamic.
Sure.
And the whole thing of deposing governments,
oh, yeah. Right. I mean, remember, just for a moment, to allude to something we're going to talk about in very short order. When Colombia tries to secure and suppress an insurrection in its breakaway province of Panama, the Colombians have to send their navy into the South Caribbean to go and stop the insurrection. Whose navy intercepts the Colombian navy before they can even get to Panama City? The United States just happened to be in the area, right? That was all speak with a big stick and you'll go far, or carry a big stick and you'll go far. That's all Rooseveltian foreign policy, very interventionist. So it does swing like a pendulum even to this day. America's interventionist urge, however, is not truly cynical or cyclical, excuse me, it might be cynical. When we love the idea of intervening abroad, and then we hate it, and then hate it, we are not changing our minds. Both instincts, according to Kinzer, coexist within us. Americans are imperialists and also isolationists. Speaking of a kind of odd paradox in Americans, given the history of the United States, we tend to value the ideas of isolationism. But then there's this tendency to also, at least, wade into the waters of exceptionalism. And if you're exceptional, then isn't it uncharitable not to share your exceptionality with the rest, the inferior? Not being very charitable if you try to hoard your exceptionality, right? We want to guide the world, but we also believe every nation should guide itself. At different times, according to circumstances, these contrary impulses emerge in different proportions. Our inability to choose between them shapes our conflicted approach to the world. Eminent figures have led the United States into conflicts from Indochina, that's Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, to Central America, to the Middle East. Others rose to challenge them. They were debating the central question of our foreign policy. Should the United States intervene to shape the fate of other nations? Much of what they said was profound. None of it was original. For generations, every debate over foreign intervention has been repetition. All are pale shadows of the first one. And guess what this book's about? The first debate about justifying American foreign intervention. Even before that debate broke out, the power of the United States was felt beyond North America. In 1805, that's quite early, a fleet dispatched by President Thomas Jefferson defeated a Barbary Coast Pasha who was extorting money from American vessels entering the Mediterranean. You guys know that. Half a century later, President Millard Fillmore sent a fleet of black ships to force Japan to open its ports to American traders. Now, as much as I've said in the past, none of us are farmers. So just as we were talking about civil rights and trying to interpret Booker T's "cast down your bucket where you are" quote from the Atlanta Compromise speech, we're not aware. We're ignorant of that because we're city folk. We're city slickers. We're also not mariners. At least you might have been to Annapolis to visit. Maybe we have some aspiring midshipmen. I don't know. But we're not on boats, and nor are we on warships often. Anybody been on a warship? All right, that's cool. Is that the USS Constitution? Okay, in Boston?
Yeah.
Okay, there you are. Old Ironsides?
Damn.
Wow. It's not the Eisenhower, it's the something else. It's retired, right?
Yeah.
Decommissioned? It's not active. Matt, your example? You were in Annapolis. Excellent. Okay. So we have three gentlemen that might know this, given their wartime experience or peacetime experience of warships. This reference to black ships. Traditionally, navies paint their ships depending on what the disposition of the Navy is. If you paint your ships white, even though they're warships, you're coming in what? Peace or war? Peace. The idea being, well, you're going to stand out, right? You're going to stand out, so you're not going to surprise attack any port or something like that, or country. This is important because you've already read about the Great White Fleet Tour, which, although the ships were painted white, those ships didn't come ultimately in total peace. Notice the first stop. What was the first stop of the Great White Fleet Tour? Tokyo. Oh. So here's what we call foreshadowing in history a little bit, right? Okay. So you have the Great White Fleet. So when Kinzer's talking about Fillmore sending a fleet of black ships to force Japan to open up its ports to American trade, are those ships coming in peace? No, they're not. It's not as though the United States, even as early as the middle, when Fillmore was president, the middle of the late 1840s, the middle of the 19th century, is already acting peaceably about just entering into voluntary trade and commercial agreements with foreign powers. No, if you close your ports to us, we'll send a fleet of black ships, at least Americans at the time were saying, I'm not implicating us, we weren't alive then, but we'll send a military force to enter to open up those ports. Those were isolated episodes, Kinzer says, and not part of a larger plan to spread American power. After both of them, troops returned home. Civil War enveloped the United States from 1861 to 1865. That doesn't surprise anyone, right? Okay. Over the decades that followed, Americans concentrated on binding their national wounds and settling the West. Only after the frontier was officially declared closed in 1890 did some begin to think of the advantages that might lie in lands beyond their own continent. That brought the United States to the edge of the world stage. Now, I would just for a moment depart from the Kinzer text here, and he does, of course, analyze this in the larger chapters of his book rather than just in the introduction. But I ask you for a bit of analysis. And forgive me if this is a kind of leaning question. I can't pose it in any other fashion, at least within my mind. And that is, should it surprise us that with the triumph of national centralized power over what ostensibly were breakaway republics from the United States, that shortly thereafter, after conquering those breakaway republics, i.e. the Confederacy and the states that were a part of it, that it would only take a few years, a couple decades, for Americans to, especially after the closing of the frontier in the West, say the United States ought to become a worldwide and global power? What's your response to that? That's a very leading question, I admit, but I forewarned you that it was going to be leading and biased. Liam?
Well, I would just say that obviously the Civil War just adds to the kind of like the passion and kind of just like being a power, being a force, and it like unites the country. People are feeling confident. And then with the entire spirit of Manifest Destiny, mm-hmm. it's just another.
Very good. So we could see this in the context of the continuance of Manifest Destiny, the new frontier being, but you said obviously. Is it so obvious that the Civil War would lead to American imperialism overseas? Let's elaborate upon that. Maybe it's obvious to us, but treat me like a sixth grade historian. How would that be so obvious? Mackenzie?
I don't think it would be obvious because I think that in some respects, will may view it as after a country's fight over such an issue, they would want to work to rebuild themselves like internally and not worry about foreign affairs or anything else because they're trying to build structure within their own nation before they expand.
The only challenge, it's a profound point that you would think with Reconstruction, you'd be worried about the reconstruction in a literal sense of the devastated South. But did the federal government pay much attention to the economic conditions that resulted in the Civil War in the South?
Not really.
In fact, for generations, the South would lag behind economically in terms of the development, even the type of investment from the federal government that was received by the South for infrastructure and the like. Grace?
I'd say that I'd argue that the central government was more concerned and preoccupied with the ideas of what they could gain and rather what they had the potential to lose after the Civil War.
Ah.
With the ideas of secession and everything, it was more this insatiable desire to acquire more and not to maintain what was already.
Excellent. Was that desire enhanced by social Darwinism? In this contest for imperial swallowing up of nations?
Yes.
I mean, it's at this very point that Europe's swallowing up Africa. There's only going to be small segments of the entire African continent that remain even ostensibly independent.
Sort of like a vulture sort of dynamic. Yes.
It's funny you use the animal vulture because in the cartoons, which sort of assailed this type of European imperialism in the swallow up of Africa, it's that the European nations all take the form of different animals. Britain's a lion or a bulldog. Russia's always a bear. Okay. Not that Russia was involved in African imperialism, but it's involved in imperialism outside of that. And why Russia's always a bear, it's because bears are really big and they're kind of considered clumsy, although I think they're quite coordinated, but in cartoons they're always, and Russia's kind of like that, really big. And if you get hit by it, you're going to die, but you can move pretty fast away from it. I feel like I don't know. I just watched Brave again, the Disney film with my kids, which is a wonderful. I don't get me wrong, I love Merida and all the Scottish accents and Merida's. Did we talk about Ralph Breaks the Internet yet?
No.
In class, has anyone seen Ralph Breaks the Internet yet?
No.
Did you? It was very good. Did you like it? It was excellent. And there's a cameo of all the Disney princesses in it, which I thought was just hilarious, throughout though, and Merida's there, they can't really understand what she's saying, and she speaks, you know, yeah, same thing. But I don't know how do we get on that? Red hair. Oh, bears, yes, and Brave has a lot of bears in it. Mm-hmm. Yes, Kelsey, you wanted to bring us back home, right, to actually what we're talking about, is that right, or did you have another question or comment?
I was just gonna end with you kind of seeing like after the Civil War and like towards the end of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
It branches out from there when they start, the Nicaraguan, their revolution where, the United States, all those different revolutions out in Central America where they were trying to, set some of their own. It comes from, an idea that the Americans have that their government, their way of life is.
It's very, very ethnocentric. I won't say ethnocentric because there's not an ethnicity American, but it's nationalistic to be sure. It's very paternalistic. Remember, as we're going to encounter in very short order, so I shouldn't say remember, but we're going to encounter this. One of Woodrow Wilson's favorite sayings regarding foreign policy was when a continual, and Mexico was always engaged in these continual revolutions, and there was a lot of concern on the part of especially Americans like William Randolph Hearst, who had, by the way, William Randolph Hearst owned an estate in Mexico at the turn of the century that was the size of the state of Rhode Island. Okay, that's how wealthy this individual was. So he has a estate, so if there's a constant revolution going on in Mexico City, the property rights of these wealthy magnates is in jeopardy, as well as American businesses heavily invested in Mexico. So Woodrow Wilson, I love this one. This isn't the first time that he's going to prove to be quite the idiot regarding geography. Geography is important. That's why it's on all of our tests. Don't be Woodrow Wilson. He said, we're going to teach these South American republics how to elect good men. There are a lot of problems with that. Okay. One, it's extremely paternalistic. Two, you're assuming that everyone south of the border are morons. And then thirdly, Mexico's not in South America. Mexico's not in South America. It's in North America. Good. So this is the type of dynamic that you're talking about, Kelsey. That's what I'm alluding to. Okay. Should we continue on? Or do we have other comments? Liam, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to say that also the expanding power of the federal government also probably played a role, because once our government just keeps getting...
That's the meaning of, I mean, they take that long when you get there. Mm-hmm. Way up, so it could actually like help the north if they got south, and based off that, like, we should go, you know, to other nations. Mm.
Okay. Yeah, there is this correlation between the rise of the United States as an economic power and Reconstruction being or taking place. People would probably say that there were those two things went hand in hand, and that the South did become industrialized over time. Did Southerners believe that they themselves were being colonized? Yes, of course they did. They thought they were being colonized yet again. Think about it. Remember in military congressional Reconstruction? There was martial law imposed. There were federal troops throughout the South. That sounds like an area that was conquered like a colony, right? How about the fact that, remember, as we looked at those electoral votes in various presidential elections, where in Southern states were excluded from participating in the presidential election? Well, that's exactly what an imperial power would do with its colonies, right? When the colonies didn't, for example, abide by what the imperial power wished for them or for the imperial power itself. Kelsey.
I think the placing of their, like, the carpetbagger,
mm-hmm.
And the
workers, like,
in the South Dakotas. It's
excellent.
Dictators being, like, president, like, being placed in the country.
Yes.
The US.
There's no real difference between a carpetbagger and a colonist. Is there?
No.
Or settler? I mean, what's the ostensible difference, the actually essential difference between some French guy from Paris who owns a mining company and he decides to establish mines in Madagascar in the 1880s and 90s and take over territory and get government contracts to have a monopoly of mining in Madagascar, and someone who, like a carpetbagger, went to the South and bought up dirt from dirt poor plantation owners, right? All this land and started businesses and factories where they didn't exist before, or built railroads to that end. There's really nothing. I mean, Vanderbilt made a fortune off of that. Vanderbilt wasn't from the South. Sometimes people think that Vanderbilt was from the South because Vanderbilt University is in Nashville. He was from New York. Okay. So in 1898, let's get to the grand debate. In 1898, Americans plunged into the farthest reaching debate in our history. It was arguably even more momentous than the debate over slavery, because its outcome affected many countries, not just one. Never has the question of intervention, says Kinsner, how the United States should face the world, been so trenchantly argued. In the history of American foreign policy, this is the mother of all debates. As the 20th century dawned, the United States faced a fateful choice. It had to decide whether to join the race for colonies, territories, and dependencies that gripped European powers. Americans understood what was at stake. The United States had been a colony. It was founded on the principle that every nation must be ruled by the consent of the governed. Yet suddenly it found itself with the chance to rule faraway lands. This prospect thrilled some Americans. It horrified others. Their debate gripped the United States. The country's best-known political and intellectual leaders took sides. Only once before, in the period when the United States was founded, have so many brilliant Americans so eloquently debated a question so fraught with meaning for all humanity. The two sides in this debate represent matched halves of the divided American soul. Should the United States project power into faraway lands? Yes, to guarantee our prosperity, save innocent lives, liberate the oppressed, and confront danger before it reaches our shores. No intervention brings suffering and creates enemies. Those are essentially the two sides, are they not? By the way, this notion of no intervention brings suffering and creates enemies, the anti-imperialist, or sometimes dubbed in a pejorative way, the isolationist stance, is extremely unpopular today. Let me prove that to you for a moment. Let's just be fair, is there an American president that has received more antagonistic, negative, even caustic coverage by the American media than Donald Trump? Yes, I was alive. You guys were alive, but you were little for the Bush years. Yeah, the media didn't like Bush, but even today they're kind of fawning over him for some real weird reason, probably because he hates Trump, right? So that just proves my point a little bit further. I do remember, and I was at the time kind of aghast by when you walked into a Barnes & Noble or Borders bookstore. Do you remember those? Never remember. Borders were around. There was one in Oak Brook, but they're gone now. Yeah, you walked into one of those bookstores, and if you went to the political science or current events section, it would be all anti-Bush books. And I thought, well, okay, especially with the warmongering, I'm sort of on board. But even then, I was too neocon. I was like, they're just being weird anti-interventionists. And beyond that, I also said, forgive me. I also said, you know, these progressives, they're just weird pacifists, and they don't live in the real world. And now I'm not a pacifist, but I'm closer to one than I ever was before. But so I look back at my reaction to that, like, ooh, that's kind of gross that I felt that way, like all these anti-Bush, and I'm more anti-Bush than probably they were back then. Long story short, though, my point here is that, did we lose connection? We did. Great. What the hell was my point? I got thrown there. Oh, yeah, Donald Trump. When was the one time when all of the news media outlets, the big ones, the Fox News, the CNNs, the MSNBC, even the networks, were all like, finally, he's acting like a president.
When Trump said he wants to put troops in places.
Yeah. When he wants to put troops in places. Or when he bombed Syria. Van Jones, the commentator, kind of radical progressive commentator at that, who worked in the Obama administration, works for CNN. When Trump bombed Syria, I believe it was about 18 months ago now, maybe a little bit over that, he said this is the first time he's acting presidential. So in order to be presidential, you have to bomb the hell out of foreign places. That's a very odd notion. But everything else, he's the devil. It's only when he's bombing people that he's good. Okay. More with Kinzer. We're going to catch up to Taft. That's not hard because he didn't run very fast anyway. Yeah. Take care. Bye, guys.